This is Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a fellow who quit a perfectly good classroom to go freeze half to death in an open cockpit, and who ended up being the man that opened up an entire territory to the airplane. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar, and today we're going north. Way north. Picture Fairbanks, Alaska, in the winter of 1922. There is no road out. There's no railroad worth the name. If you want to get from one town to the next, you hitch up a dog team and you mush, and it takes you days, sometimes weeks, and the whole time the cold is trying to kill you. That was Alaska, a country the size of a continent, tied together by dogs and rivers and a whole lot of patience. And into that country walks a 25-year-old schoolteacher from Hatton, North Dakota, named Carl Ben Eielson. Now here's where it gets interesting, because Ben Eielson wasn't just a schoolteacher, he'd learned to fly during the First World War. Got his wings, never got sent overseas, and came home with the sickness. You pilots know the one I mean. Once you've had the stick in your hand and felt the ground let go, you don't ever really come all the way back down. He'd caught it bad. And when he took that teaching job up in Fairbanks, he brought the sickness with him. Before we get too far into the ice, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, a man like Eielson never got a coin for the things he did. They gave him medals, sure, but a coin's a different thing. It's the one you carry. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. So, Fairbanks, 1922. Ben Eielson gets a handful of local businessmen to chip in. And they buy a war surplus airplane, a little Curtiss trainer, and Eielson starts flying folks around for money. First real airplane operation in interior Alaska. And right away, he's learning things that no flight school ever taught, because no flight school had ever tried to teach them. He's learning what happens to an engine at 40 below zero. He's learning that the oil in your crankcase turns to something like cold molasses, and that if you shut the engine down out in the bush, you may never get it started again unless you drain that oil hot and carry it inside by the fire. He's learning that there are no airports, none. You land on a frozen river, you land on a sandbar, you land on a stretch of tundra some trapper swore was smooth, and you find out he lied. And he's learning that the maps are blank. I don't mean sparse, I mean blank. White paper. Great stretches of Alaska in those days had simply never been surveyed from the air. And Eielson was flying over country where if that engine quit, nobody on this earth knew exactly where you were, including you. Back when avgas was cheap and airspace was free, that's the kind of flying that separated the pilots from the passengers. Now the post office had been watching. See? The government had this problem. They were paying a fortune to move the mail across Alaska by dog sled. And somebody in Washington had the bright idea. What if the airplane could do it? So in the winter of 1924, the government handed Ben Eielson a contract and an airplane, a de Havilland DH-4, a big heavy war surplus. Biplane with a Liberty engine up front, open cockpit, the whole thing built for the battlefields of France, not for this. February 1924, Eielson loads up the mail and points that DH-4 from Fairbanks toward the little town of McGrath, better than 280 miles off, across the mountains and the river valleys. Now think about what he's wearing, because the airplane's got no heater and no canopy. He's in furs, reindeer skin parka, fur boots, they called muklooks, a face mask, and even then the wind coming over that cowling is finding every gap. His breath is freezing on the fur around his face. The controls are stiff with the cold. And there's the noise, that big Liberty engine hammering away 12 inches in front of him, a sound you don't so much hear as feel in your chest for the rest of the day. The dog teams took anywhere from a week to 20 days to make that run to McGrath. Ben Eielson did it in a little under 3 hours. Let that land for a second. A trip that ate up the better part of a month, that cost the government a small fortune in dogs and drivers and dried salmon to feed them, and this one cold, half-frozen schoolteacher just folded it up into an afternoon. The people of McGrath heard the engine and came running out onto the river ice, and there's their mail, dropped out of the sky, and Eielson climbing down out of that cockpit stiff as a board and grinning like a kid. He flew that route through the winter, 8 trips thereabouts, and then it bit him. On one of those flights, the DH-4 came down hard, wrecked the airplane, and Eielson walked away, but the government got nervous about the whole business and canceled the contract. Too risky, they said, too much money in the equipment. And they went back to the dogs, but you can't put that back in the box. Everybody in Alaska had seen it now. They'd seen the mail arrive in an afternoon, the idea was loose, and it was never going back. Now here's where Eielson's story turns from bush pilot to something bigger. There was an explorer, an Australian, named Hubert Wilkins. Sir Hubert eventually, and Wilkins had a wild notion. He wanted to prove there was no undiscovered land up in the top of the world, up over the Arctic Ocean, and he wanted to do it the modern way, not with dogs and starvation and men dying in the ice like the old expeditions. He wanted to fly across the top of the planet. And he needed a pilot who could fly in a place with no airfields, no weather reports, no radios worth a darn, and temperatures that would crack steel. He needed a man who'd already been doing exactly that for a paycheck. He found Ben Eielson, April 1928, Point Barrow, Alaska, the very top of the continent. Eielson and Wilkins climb into a Lockheed Vega, a sleek little monoplane, wooden, clean lines, way ahead of its time, and they point the nose out over the frozen Arctic Ocean toward Spitsbergen, Norway. That's on the far side of the North Pole. They're going to fly across the top of the world, over ice nobody had ever seen, with the nearest help a couple thousand miles in any direction. 20 hours in the air, 20 hours over a white nothing, the two of them navigating by dead reckoning and the sun, because up there a magnetic compass is about as much use as a paperweight. They ran into weather near the end, socked in, and Eielson had to put that Vega down on a patch of sea ice off the coast of Spitsbergen and wait out the storm. Sat there for days, then dug it out, got it running, and flew the last leg in. They made it, first men to fly across the top of the world from America to Europe. The King of England knighted Wilkins, and Eielson, the schoolteacher from North Dakota, got the Distinguished Flying Cross and dinner with presidents. Then the two of them turned right around and did nearly the same thing at the bottom of the planet, flying a Vega over the mountains and ice of Antarctica, spotting land no human eye had ever seen. By 1929, Ben Eielson was famous. Genuinely famous, the way Lindbergh was famous, and he could have cashed it in. Lecture tours, a desk, a nice warm office, somewhere in the lower 48. He went back to Alaska instead, because he had a company to run now, and airplanes to fly, and the sickness never did let go of him. Which brings us to the ice off Siberia, and the part of this story that still puts a lump in my throat. There was a trading ship called the Nanook, and in the fall of 1929 she got herself frozen fast in the ice off the coast of Siberia, over on the far side of the Bering Strait. And she was loaded, better than $500,000 in furs sitting in her hold, and a crew and some passengers stuck out there with the whole Arctic winter closing down on top of them. The call went out, and Ben Eielson answered it, because of course he did. The plan was to fly across the Bering Strait from Alaska, land on the ice next to the Nanook, and start ferrying out the furs and the people, load by load, before the deep cold shut everything down for good. Eielson took a Hamilton metal plane, an all-metal monoplane, good sturdy airplane, and his mechanic, a young fella named Earl Borland, and they started making the crossing, November 1929. He made a trip or two out to the Nanook and back, and then on the 9th of November, Eielson and Borland took off from the Alaska side to make another run across to the ship. They flew into weather, and they never came out of it. Nothing. No radio call, no wreck, no sign, just the biggest, coldest, emptiest country on Earth. And two men and an airplane swallowed up somewhere out over the Strait or the Siberian coast. Now here's the thing that tells you who Ben Eielson was, by who came looking for him. The whole world came looking. American pilots flew search patterns off the Alaska coast. And on the other side, the Soviets, and remember this is 1929, this is not a friendly time between those two countries. The Soviets put their own pilots and their own men in the air and on the ice searching for him too, because up in that country the flyer's code runs deeper than any government. You go looking, you always go looking. And Ben Eielson had spent his whole life being the man who went looking for everybody else. Now it was their turn. They searched through the dark heart of that Arctic winter, for weeks, and finally in late January of 1930, out on the frozen Siberian coast, they found the Hamilton metal plane. Wrecked in the snow, flown straight into the ground in bad weather, the way it takes so many of them, the way it very nearly took Eielson a dozen times before. They found Ben Eielson and Earl Borland nearby. He was 32 years old. 32 he'd flown Alaska's first airmail, he'd flown across the top of the world and the bottom of it. He'd shown an entire territory that the airplane could shrink a country that dogs took a month to cross down to an afternoon, and he did all of it in about 7 years. 7 years from that first surplus trainer in Fairbanks to a wrecked metal plane on the Siberian ice. Now I could leave it there, and it'd be a sad story, and that's all. But I don't think that's the right ending, and I don't think Eielson would want it to be. Because look at what he started. Every bush pilot who ever put a cub or a beaver down on a gravel bar in the Alaska Range is flying in Ben Eielson's slipstream. Every load of medicine, every sick kid flown out of a village to a hospital, every hunter, every fisherman, every mail sack that gets to a place with no road, all of that traces back to a school teacher who looked at a blank map and decided the airplane belonged there. And they didn't forget him. There's a United States Air Force base in the interior of Alaska, big one, and it's called Eielson Air Force Base, named for that man. Every fighter that thunders off the runway there is taking off from a field that carries the name of a fella who used to land a war surplus biplane on frozen rivers because there wasn't anything else to land on. That's not a bad way to be remembered. My thanks to the historians who've kept Ben Eielson's story alive, to the folks at the Smithsonian, and to everybody up at Eielson Air Force Base who make sure the interior of Alaska remembers whose name is on the gate. You can find us at RadioHangar.com.
Next time you're bundled up on a cold morning, waiting for the oil temp to come off the peg before you push the throttle up, think about a man doing that at 40 below with no canopy and no map and a country full of people counting on him. We've got it awful easy, you and me. Fly safe out there.